Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. This week we decamped to Prague to join the attendees of this year's ReCite conference. Exploring the theme of regeneration, we bring you conversations and contemplations from some of the most interesting names in the urban planning world. From top architects,
if we really want to make a big change, the whole system needs to change.
To city mayors.
It's not a choice that we have to work with the youth. It's an obligation because they are claiming their rights.
We find out how to grow sustainably, start the right conversations, and build better cities for future generations. All that coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist, with our man on the ground, David Stevens.
Inside a cavernous three-story hall with two enormous screens and a 360-degree stage, it's clear we're not here to think small, but rethinking our urban landscapes, and perhaps more importantly, our attitudes, is a big job. It needs big gestures. That song, which welcomed the 1,000-plus attendees to this 8th edition of ReCite, along with the thunderous sound and light show, was Chicago by Sufjan Stevens. And it's set about our task over the course of the next 2 days. We're here to recreate, and we're here to grow, or to put it simply, regenerate, as is the theme of this year's event. And ReCite's Eastern European home couldn't be a more suitable setting.
For 30 years, there's not a lot of big urban projects happening on open spaces, which are in the center of the city. There's lots of reasons for that, like mostly the post-communist history. And Prague has a pretty high concentration of these large urban development areas, brownfields, post-industrial sites, like in the city center.
That's ReCite's founder and chairman, Martin Barry. So what is it about Prague that perfectly exemplifies this regeneration ethic?
The last 2 years, like, stuff starting to move. The city has put out a new metropolitan plan and said that they want to develop these higher density areas in the center of the city and kind of stop expansion in greenfields. That's been our message for years since we started ReCite in 2012, to kind of re-densify areas in cities, not just Prague, but anywhere in the world. We think kind of smart density and soft density with adequate open space is the right way to develop a city. And so the city of Prague has kind of come on board with that mentality, and there are some better conversations between them and the private sector to develop these areas. So that we've seen some plans and competitions for large-scale urban development projects in the center of Prague. So I think, like, the topic of regenerate is pretty topical and current right now.
Talking of conversations, there was no shortage of inspiring speakers circulating the center stage. And to help unpack such a big topic, the program was broken down into a few digestible blocks, one of which was titled Gardens in the Machine, which explored the ways in which our cities could learn from nature and attempt to rewild the right way.
All of these things that we put plants in buildings, that we put food on rooftops, that we put parks in cities, this is all just greenwashing. I mean, it treats the symptoms a little bit, but it doesn't treat the roots. And I think if we really want to make a big change, the whole system needs to change.
That's Chris Precht, the co-founder of Studio Precht, and one of this topic's most inspiring speakers. We spoke with Chris on The Urbanist back in April for our episode on city rooftops. And it's clear, looking at the studio's modular agriculture and housing concept, the farmhouse, that conscious consumption and green integration remains fundamental to Chris's work.
If you really know how much work goes into growing your food, you would value that more. But at the moment, this is not in our mind because the food production moved outside. The food production became a business. And with every business, it's about profit. And I think there is a big problem of how we grow our food and what we eat. How we grow our food actually uses more than 70% of our drinking water. You know, you see when jungles and the Amazon is burning in order to make more space for our food production. But also what we eat is a big problem because we are not connected to this process, because we don't value food. We have a big problem with obesity and diabetes and so forth. So I think it starts really with the possibility to grow your food by yourself, to really value how much work it is to grow a tomato. We grow our food by ourselves and maybe it tastes better, but that's not so much the point. But because you're constantly surrounded by that, by this magic of how life gets created and how life grows, that, you know, there is a deep connection then to the food and you live much healthier as in kind of an aftermath.
Is there a way, or should there be a way, to attach economic value to having these green spaces? Is that the way to make sure that these things are consented, is to show that actually they can help the economy as well? And how can they?
Yeah, I mean, it starts with a very easy solution, and that would be paying real prices for things, right? Because you make profit by destroying the future, but you also make profit by exploiting workforce, by exploiting other countries and so forth. So paying real prices for things would help, of course. A CO2 tax, of course, would also help. But all of these things, I think, are just what we need to do in any way. But I think it needs to continue then with a whole different mindset of people, of how important really the ecology is and what we can gain from nature. Because, I mean, we share still our DNA with our hunter and gatherer's ancestors, right? And within one evolutional second, we stand in a supermarket and in Austria we can buy tomatoes from Spain or from New Zealand. But I think we lost a lot in this process. We lost this connection to reality. We lost this connection to nature and to the environment. And I think we need to bring this somehow back.
Clearly, Chris has plenty of big ideas. And speaking of size, the so-called problem of bigness was brought to the fore with celebrated British designer Thomas Heatherwick during Thursday's keynote. For Heatherwick, engaging the public at every level and creating human connections when it comes to big projects is essential. And what bigger project than an entire city?
What I saw immediately is the incredible potentialities of this territory.
That's Inês de Medeiros, elected in 2017 as mayor of the Portuguese city of Almada, which sits just across the water from the capital. She told us how she approached her project south of the Tagus.
You need to see Almada a little bit like the relationship between Brooklyn and Manhattan. Like, you have Lisbon and you have Almada just in front, who is the place where sometimes people who can't live anymore in Lisbon because it's too expensive, young people, young families, or where artists don't have a place anymore to go, or because we have a huge university of science and technology where you can have experimental and research. So you see this incredible dynamic of this city, and in the same time in the geographical position, wonderful, because we have the river and we have the sea. We have 13 kilometers of beach, and in the same time you have this incredible space of nature. It's amazing to see how an industrial city come transform themselves to be one of the best places to live, because you have all the ingredients you need to have quality of life in every sense.
It's hard to imagine a project bigger than an entire city, but understanding the history of the environment that these projects exist in is crucial to building things that fit in with their landscape. In the case of a building, for example, past uses of the space should inform what comes after. Wallace Liu are a small architecture firm with big plans. In the current project, the Chongqing Industrial Museum, which is situated within the remaining sheds of the Chongqing Steelworks, is a perfect example of keeping a vein of history running through redevelopment.
When we design, Jie and I, when we design together, we talk a lot about character and experience, right? And so when we work with old things, it doesn't really matter what it is, or existing things, even if it's a curbstone or a tree or a building or a structure, it's like, how do we utilize those things to create more drama or more experience and kind of build off of those? And so I would say that's kind of our approach to this thing, rather than the kind of memories that are embedded in it, although of course that might inform part of the kind of experience, but it's very much about using what's there, reframing it to create more from it.
Chinese development was clearly a hot topic, and ReCite aimed to explore this notion in their East Meets West block. Having spent the last 5 years based in China before recently relocating to London, Wallace Liu's founders Jamie Wallace and Ji Liu have first-hand experience drawing from both Eastern and Western influences. So, how do those styles manifest in their work?
I don't think there's such a strong divide in visual language between East and West anymore. As with the young generation of architecture, the world is blending in one big pot. But we do have our personal language that we brought into the project. For example, our relationship between the new and the old is always quite dynamic. It's always about increasing the amount of grey areas whatever we can. And these areas will be made in layered language so people will be able to feel free to explore. It's about breaking down delineations and boundaries and restrictions of free movement as well. And I think that is a design language we consistently apply to a few of our projects. And in the museum projects, it's just become visually, because it has this amazing old backing of an old steel factory, visually it becomes very strong.
China wasn't the only source of inspiration in the block. We were also offered the chance to look further east with the Japanese-born architect Yosuke Hayano, who is one of the principal partners at Beijing's MAD Architects.
I think about contemporary architecture, it seems Japan, China has quite different, but like deep in the history, I believe like we have a lot of common understanding about how to understand the world or nature, how to design the space for architecture, a space for the people, to having kind of balance between people and nature. I think I'm quite interested about understand what is the key, like a core of like understanding of the space in Asia, the how we can bring this kind of spirit or philosophy back to the contemporary world where we live.
But for MAD architects, it's not just about building for now, it's about looking to the future.
I think in the reality, and China having lots of need for new architecture, need for new urban space, but I think like for us, it's important like we have kind of vision how this future of the city can be better place for the people, like how this architecture can help to push, not chasing for only for the economical aspects, square meter, efficiency, but how we can keep space for the people. I think that's why our office, we have very diverse architectural typology, which try to visualize our vision of the future city. I think that's going to help to open eye for the people.
We also managed to spare a moment with Italian-born curator and critic Beatrice Lianza, who worked for over a decade in China. Lianza wants to refocus our efforts and reassess just what it is we're aiming to regenerate.
I think it's more about the ideas, because it's not about finding right models, it's finding adaptive methodologies that can be replicated. And I think critically this comes in the hands of the younger generations that are going to be, you know, like in the role and in the place of moderating these future conversations for themselves and others. So I think that conversation is always hard to have, and not just in China. You know, for once, Chinese exceptionalism doesn't really apply here. But in general, I would say with an imposed kind of situation, which comes now particularly with the fact that governmental directives don't allow to build anything anymore, really, especially not in first-tier cities, so like Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou. There is room to have this conversation become more of the norm in the second and third tier cities, where not only there is an existing city, but where there is a whole new kind of population, you know, like coming in. And often younger populations, right, that abandon, you know, the fast pace, you know, like of busy cities like that. So if they are capable to keep this conversation up, then I think that they are walking in the right directions. I believe that a lot has to be done from the side of education. And the thing that worries me the most is that you have to imagine that in China every year, particularly from technical schools, which include architecture, urbanism, and design, there are something like 4 million people coming out every year. So if they get it wrong,
it's a big problem. So that's also what I have been working on a lot in the past couple of years with my projects back in Beijing with Beside Design and the Global School. So I think that that's an issue that deserves actually a very big conversation, not just in China, really.
So what else did this year's curators want to direct their attention to in the city building sphere? Here's ReCite's founder and chairman, Martin Barry, again.
I think the role of arts, like the art of city making, we're calling it, and the role of arts and regeneration is a really poignant one, because there's some really thorny questions about how do you regenerate a district or an area with arts and culture. Of course, like everyone knows the case of Brooklyn or now Detroit, like if you've got a kind of crappy urban area that's like undervalued, you send the artist there, and or the artists find it, and it becomes a creative center. Soon after, then the developers find it, and the city wants to, you know, take advantage also, so they rezone it, and then you like mostly upzoning or allowing more building rights, and then all of a sudden the artists can't afford it, right? It's a common story in cities. We're having a discussion right at this moment at ReCite about how to handle this better, how to not displace residents when you have larger scale kind of arts regeneration. In the case of Lincoln Center in the 1950s or 60s in New York, a really good example of displacement of like over 7,000 people and not even finding them new homes. So we're talking about things like that right now. And the role of institutions, so cultural institutions, to kind of rethink and rebrand neighborhoods, but do it in a way that's not displacing existing community, existing residents, by kind of including them in the process. So the question is, like, who do you talk to when you're creating these kinds of projects, and how do you incorporate their voice?
For regular citizens, often the toughest portion of their civic contribution to justify is the part going to arts funding, and changing those attitudes is hard. But some simple cost-benefit analysis could get the idea over the line. Here's Almada's mayor, Inés de Medeiros, again.
The point is, if you see in a social economic way, it's very fun to see how much, if you want economic growth, you need to look at the art area. It's where you can create most easily and more quickly jobs, and in the same time is where you have the biggest innovation, creativity. And the point is that people don't understand is a little bit like science. People love science when we go to the pharmacy and we are ill. And sometimes they don't understand what is fundamental research. And art is the same thing. Is if you want to have better life, if you want to have nicer houses, if you want to, you need fundamental research, who is art, pure art, and artists who are the very greatest inventor. We need science and fundamental research to grow and to develop and to create a better world. Like we need art, pure creativity, also for the same purpose.
As part of the Echigo Sumari art field, inviting artists to collaborate with local residents to place their work in the natural landscape, MAD architects were invited to regenerate a series of viewing platforms in the Kyotsu Gorge Tunnel. The results are a collection of unmistakably stunning works of art, culminating in a particularly photo-friendly final vista. Here's MAD's Yosuke Hayano again.
The condition was to demolish the entrance facility next to the entrance of tunnel to build proper ticketing shop and the gathering point. The second is put the public toilet inside of the tunnel. The third, to do something artistic articulation for the final last space to attract the people to come. Then our reaction was, just doing three out of the whole tunnel doesn't help. But we have to approach, we have to think overall how to regenerate the image of this tunnel, how to merge with a new kind of urban space. So that's why we proposed to transform this tunnel, because it was acting as a path to reach to the each platform to see the view. But we thought it should be become a kind of museum or become a journey for people, leave from reality, leave from daily life, move to the art world to see the beautiful scenery, nature, in different way, using different natural element, water, fire, or metal, or wind. So that's why each space, we use different element to trigger people's emotional reaction. At the end, at the last space, we transform the space by putting the water surface, this water, coming from the river outside, which is very cold because it's like coming from snow mountain. But like this, it's going to make clear reflection of the view from the outside. Also, people can go into this water by feeling very coldness on their foot, then reach to the edge to see the canyon, to see the river, but also like a feeling you are standing in between the nature and the artificial. So you also like you're going to have your kind of emotional reaction, emotional connection to this space, to this nature. I think that's quite important, like people responding in different way. Each of them visiting here, they find their one emotion reacting to this space. If we can have this kind of space, can trigger to touch people's emotion in different way, more in the urban space, this city gonna be more rich and people think this city belongs to them.
By sheer chance, day two of ReCite 2019 fell on the same day as a worldwide youth-led climate protest. On Friday, September 20th, millions of people in over 100 countries took to the streets, frustrated with the inaction of national and city governments towards tackling climate change.
This is an emergency. Our house is on fire. Why should we study for a future that is being taken away from us?
Extra, extra, read all about it! Climate change is real, and
you say there are hundreds of protests going on all around the world today as young people, school children from Australia to Iceland come together to protest about what they're calling the crisis of their lifetime. Climate change, of course, and what they see is politicians' inability or unwillingness to do anything about it.
The soil, no more coal, no more oil, keep your carbon.
And some people say we should study to become climate scientists or politicians so that we can, in the future, solve the climate crisis. But by then it will be too late. We need to do this now.
When you're talking about climate change, you're talking about my future. I will live to see the ramifications and suffering if we don't do something about it. And that extends to urbanism.
Kate Wagner is an architecture critic based in Washington, D.C. And she suspects she might be the youngest speaker here at ReCite. So this conversation is about people like her. What's her unique way of affecting change? She runs a blog critiquing that classic show of suburban American hubris, the McMansion.
A McMansion is generally a large American suburban home that came about as a phenomenon starting in the 1980s and is basically an oversized house that is comprised of several different architectural styles and window shapes and forms all sort of cobbled together in a rather chunkily integrated way. Very much a symbol of conspicuous consumption. That's why the alternative names are the Garage Mahal and the Hummer House.
But the idea of a dream home for those entering the housing market today has changed significantly.
Now the idea of wealth is sort of jet-setting, globe-trotting, Airbnb surfing, Instagram celebrity. So it's very different now. It's about communicating what you've done or what you're doing, and sometimes what you own, rather than just stockpiling everything in a huge house. This is a very big difference because you're shifting your mentality away from objects, specifically objects that are very traditional aesthetically. It's not about having a big house anymore. It's about having posh urban living. I mean, I know I'm on Instagram. If you see where these people live, and it's not like Instagram celebrities aren't like, here's my McMansion, right? They're like, here's my $1.2 billion high-rise apartment penthouse in New York. It's just a very different shift in luxury towards a more urban scene. And so, yeah, I guess sprawl is just a really outdated view of what luxury is now. I mean, luxury and development and investment and the financialization of real estate has really left the suburbs behind and has moved on to urban spaces as being seen as the center of all value.
So how do we enable the younger generation to speak up and let their voices be heard? Well, perhaps that process goes both ways. And Almada Mayor Inés de Medeiros has something to say about that too.
I think we are very lucky because it's the younger ones. We don't need to teach them that they should change their behaviors because it's important. They are teaching us that we need to change our behaviors. And this is very easy because it's a reverse challenge. They are taking power of their futures right now and saying, we want to have a future. So we really need to look at youth, not like a project, but like a reality now. And that's what they are asking us who have children. Our children are saying that to us and saying, okay, you are my parents, but what are you doing for me now, for me to be an adult tomorrow? And so it's not a choice that we have to work with the youth. It's an obligation because they are claiming their rights. It's not a choice, it's a right.
However, future plans can't stop at ribbon-cutting ceremonies and redevelopments opening to the public. We are temporary, just like our structures. And if we're going to regenerate in a sustainable way, planning for what comes afterwards is just as important. For architect Chris Precht, this is a vital part of the discussion.
Everything is a temporary structure. Some exist longer, some less long, but everything is somehow temporary. Every building has its own lifespan. But there is too less of a thinking of how can we actually dismantle a building after its lifespan. You know, in every building there are a lot of really valuable resources. If we just demolish those, we bury all the resources underneath. So I think architects think a lot about how we can build up structures, but very little about how we can take down structures after their lifespan. So yes, I think we should much more think about those ecological circles and loops of building materials, of how to create a second life for all of those elements.
And a third life, and a fourth life, and a fifth. Because regeneration doesn't stop. If nothing else, we need confidence in our own abilities. We can start again, we can regenerate, and we can prepare for what comes after. All things grow, and all things go. For Monocle, in Prague, I'm David Stevens.
And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's show was produced and edited by David Stevens. Do tune in next week too as we dive deeper in some of the big projects and big ideas discussed at this year's Recite. But to play you out of this episode, here's Sufjan Stevens with Chicago. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.